The subject of our lecture this afternoon is factors in the third culture which make re-entry difficult for an MK, that is, the problems in the children themselves and in their upbringing on the field. And we're going to talk about that. It may answer some of the questions that were thrown into the ring this morning with regard to preparing a child to come back. MKs are usually relatively unaffected by changes in their third culture environment up to the time they return to their own country. There are ripples of change as friends go and come on home leave, or teachers come and go due to furlough or contract appointments. One exception to this general rule are teenagers who come with their family when the father has been invited for a special assignment. We're talking about teenagers, not little children now. When their father has been invited for a special assignment, usually in a Bible school or hospital or other institutional body. The teenagers, because it is in their restless years, resent the dislocation of their lifestyle and may come out to the mission field with some degree of rebellion, taking it out on their family or on the school. But the majority of this group usually adjust very well and quickly come to enjoy the new cultural advantages. Where they hate it, it is not due to culture shock. That's a luxury emotion for their parents. It is due to their own set of frustrations. When they return, things have changed at home, resulting in another set of frustrations. Sometime later, they will probably find it was a useful part of their education after all. The term re-entry has been widely used to describe the return of overseas kids to their own home country. In the first lecture, I suggested that MKs return to their home country as citizens only to discover that culturally they are foreigners. Or to put it in another way, they are like E.T. coming to Earth, or like a space capsule returning to Earth's atmosphere. The emotional reactions may have a searing effect, quite devastating at first. I don't know how much the counselling for the re-entry helps. I rather think it is in the development of the MK's cultural roots that they can best cope with the new culture. Not just a heap of advice about an unreal situation in the homeland, what is unreal to them, I mean. But the development of their own personal relationships with their family and a personal relationship with God. It would be interesting to study the Australian MKs, their return and reactions at that time, and their progress and adjustments academically, socially, and in spiritual life. It would be a very difficult piece of research because our population is small and scattered. An American researcher found it very difficult to get data out of missionary societies and suggested that it may be related to the need to keep a good face for their public relations. And in America, they are forever researching things. In Australia, we are not so easily drawn into self-revealing inquiries. But I think the problem may be harder and deeper than that. MKs were little non-persons who accompanied their parents on their furlough, travelling. They were out of their routine life, and people think of them in terms of a mental picture formed in less than ideal circumstances. But we need to think of people not in terms of a few still photographs, but in terms of a movie film. For we will defeat the purpose of an inquiry if we say, I remember so-and-so, nice parents, but the kid was an unmitigated pill. That is a photograph that doesn't change. Only the date changes on the picture. To alter the illustration, we are studying a fluid situation when we look at a young person, even an MK. They are not one drip forever, but have become a stream of personal development. Let's bring it closer to home. If eldership in an assembly were based on our behaviour in Bible camp, who of us could stand? I wrote in notes prepared for a seminar for missionary parents, each MK is custom made by God. Their inherited disposition, their learned cultural ways, and their own spiritual experiences are so much a part of themselves that we cannot reduce them to stereotype. Well, you say, that can be said of all young people. That's true. And we need to be constantly reminded of this. Perhaps this is to be one of the side effects of this seminar. If it will but teach us to think of a flow of growth in young people in our assemblies and churches, then we will learn tolerance, patience, and hope. And when young people come from the country, awkward in their attitude or speech, bumbling in their adjustments to city life, we will get down from our high horse onto our knees and ask for tolerance and patience and hope. When real foreigners come to us with their non-Australian cultural behaviour, speech that is sometimes hard to understand, and ways of thinking drawn from different wells, we can pray again for tolerance and patience and hope. Just because an MK comes from a Christian worker's home, do we expect instant mature sainthood? Come to think of it, weren't his parents partners of our youthful pranks and escapades? We say, the MK talks like a Yank, funny accent. Could it be that the MK finds our speech difficult to understand? We say, that MK from Africa thinks like an Americanized Moroccan. Or, if the MK is home from New Guinea, we say his hair is mouse brown, but his thoughts are fuzzy-wuzzy. We find it difficult to accept foreigners because we have well-defined norms of cultural behaviour, and sometimes what is simply cultural we call spiritual standards, and we are intolerant and impatient and hold out no hope. Dr. Danielson, I've mentioned him before, he's been working with MKs in South America and in the Philippines. He's with the Missionary Aviation Fellowship. He has written a book, Missionary Children, MKs. He has a section where he lists the problems MKs have on returning home to USA, problems which rise out of the cultural environment of the third culture. Actually, most of his writings are taken from conversations he had with young people themselves, and not just his imaginings of what they would feel. I have borrowed not just his axe, but his toolkit. But for the use of it, I accept responsibility. His first point is the disposition of the MK. The psychological profiles of MKs are as different as their faces. Some are naturally reserved and meet new situations timidly. Things which are normal to those in the home country may be beyond the learned experience of the MK. It happened over 40 years ago, the day my sister arrived in South Australia. Her aunt asked her to fill a jug with water. She looked in several rooms for a large earthenware jar from which she could draw boiled water. She had graduated from high school without the experience of drinking water from a tap. Some are by disposition much more outgoing and enjoy new challenges. Our eldest daughter's husband is also an MK from Ecuador. His parents worked with the HCJB. When he returned to the USA after high school, he found cream cookies and a special milkshake wonderfully cheap. He accepted the challenge so enthusiastically that he's hung the scars around his waist ever since. It's probably rare now, but some of us in our teens fought shy of the telephone. Was it friend or foe? And actually, to this day, I hate to talk on a phone with somebody else nearby. A sense of responsibility is the second point. On the mission field and in the third culture community life, the opportunities for an MK to develop a sense of responsibility are comparatively small. Official papers are handled by parents or school administrators, as these so often involve encounters with officials, language difference, and the precious passports, visas, travel documents, and residence permits. there are fewer calls for MKs to make plans and carry them through in the limited environment they live in. Most peer group activities are scheduled. Is that the right way, or scheduled? Scheduled. Decisions are usually only in the small adjustments of larger plans made by others. If, as the Chinese say, his outlook is like a frog's from the bottom of a well, how well are MKs equipped or trained to make decisions on their own which will have far-reaching consequences? To whom can they look for counsel? The third point is relationships. MKs usually have good rapport with fellow MKs, a sort of loyal, mutual understanding of one another. When they return to their home country, they bring a different box of cultural interests, and they often find it hard to make real contact with other people. They need friends, but group friends are already formed, and a foreigner is not quickly welcomed. This is something to be on the watch for, the isolated, withdrawn loner, because in our prison society, too many young people are solving the problems of loneliness with drugs or in some other self-destroying activities. In relationships on the mission field, there are standards, usually high, moral, and conservative, which are understood as the mores of the peer pack. If an MK deviates, peer pressure has a supportive, recuperative function, and these are helpful in the turbulent teen years. When the MK returns to the home country, these are suddenly removed. The new peer group is not so closely knit, nor so mutually supportive. And if the MK makes a stupid mistake, who is going to take the trouble to help him or her to adjust? After all, ignorance and weakness may not be sinful. But where a high set of behavioural values have been formed, a young person can feel guilt. What the MK needs is restoring guidance. Another problem in relationships when MKs return is due to what they have seen of people in poverty, disability, or need. They have seen in their parents or other missionaries a lot of service for their fellow men, which has been motivated by love for God and love for our neighbour. They see what appears to be life motivated by self-interest when they come back home. Sometimes they react by withdrawing, not by speaking about it. You may say, "Aren't you making straw angels out of MKs?" No, I'm not making straw angels or straw devils out of MKs. These are real people with this kind of reaction. If you research their later development, you will find that many are in social, people-orientated work. They have learned to regard self-interest as a poor motivating force for a life's work. The fourth point is with regard to finances and attitudes to work. MKs on the field have very limited understanding of money and business matters. This is not because their parents haven't money, nor is it because their parents are frugal. It is because there is not the same opportunity for using money, nor for earning it, so they haven't a clear, educated way, idea of its value or its purchasing power, nor why, when it is spent, it doesn't come back again. With regard to cash, most MKs go flat broke in a joyful early splurge when they return home. It's the price of good education. The trouble is, if their parents are thousands of miles away, how do they handle instant poverty? How do you learn to budget when you are on a minimal income? I did 2 years of matriculation class and then a medical course, and I had 2 shillings and 6 pence a week pocket money, except in holiday times, when I could earn a little more. The first year after graduating, I earned £5.08 a week as a house surgeon, but I couldn't make a balance sheet that balanced after a year. I knew what the hospital gave me, I knew what was left in the savings account, and black was beautiful. Hmm? That's all I knew about how to set up accounts. Now, with regard to checks, how do you handle checks? Previously, because of banking and foreign exchange regulations and identification papers and seals and a fistful of forms, that was Dad's duty. In Australia, it is not a hassle, but for an MK, it can be as nerve-wracking as it was to Stephen Leacock. Do you know his story? Hmm? Who do you ask for help? Has anyone offered to help? It is rare to find a Christian accountant or banker explaining this sort of thing to a young people's fellowship in any culture. And I think that this is quite an important thing, maybe to develop the idea that responsibility with regard to financial things is worth at least one evening a year in any youth group. With regard to work, MKs are usually good workers and have quite high ethics. They may have a few adjustments as to status and work. I was a bit taken aback to see white people working on the walls when we arrived in Brisbane from China. I had only seen Chinese and Indian labourers. It gives a different kind of a shock to see anybody work on the walls now. MKs may be quite ill-informed regarding unions, wages, tea breaks and workers' rights, overtime and other things which are normal to our Australian society. Missionaries have their rights. They still have the right not to demand their rights. Somebody mentioned this problem of missionary kids sometimes in a home sort of standing back and not taking part in the housework and so on. I think that mostly this is not because they're unwilling to, it's just that they don't know how to. They haven't the advantage I had when I arrived back from Australia back to Adelaide as a teenager. We had a large family group, and there were about 20 to 30 to tea that night, and we were all milling around together. And when the washing up started, one of my cousins just handed me a tea towel and said, here you are, Don. And it's been that way ever since. But sometimes young people, when they come back, just simply do not know how to make the offer to help or what's expected of them. So just a little kindly or a little sort of a joking invitation to work, and they usually will join in quite happily and work very well. Now, a fifth point is the change of pace in lifestyle. Most MKs are brought up in a third culture community which keeps to time within a host country where the clock is a friendly reminder but not the tyrant of their lives. In some cultures, it is not courteous to arrive at the time appointed. If you are invited to a meal, if you're invited to a feast, to be there any time within an hour of the time that they mentioned is still quite within courtesy. This may irritate Australian hostesses if that cultural behaviour is imported. The Chinese Bible doesn't have the finger-wagging association of the words, and when the hour was come, he sat down with his disciples. As to vacations, would you have thought that vacations would provide a problem to an MK? After all, you had only seen him when his family were on furlough during their vacation time. Actually, holidays are not all that easily arranged on the field. Because of the parents' work program, family finances, and the inconvenience of holiday accommodation. Do you think that home country Christians could be concerned about not holidays on the field, but holidaying in the homeland, where to go and how to pay for it? In some, probably most mission fields, young MKs are, by law, prevented from entering the local workforce. Jobs may be made for them on the school campus or in mission work, but they can't get into the national workforce. That may make them appear unwilling to look for a job. It may simply be that they don't know where and how to go about it. Could anyone come up with ideas to help in that situation? A seventh point Dr. Danielson makes is red tape. Different countries have different thicknesses of red tape. Usually, the MK does not handle any official forms in the host country. Language, passports, which must never be mislaid, permits, and so on. That's quite an interesting point. We had a family come from Thailand over to Taiwan. Their girls were coming over to school in the Morrison Academy, and father had the suitcase with all their passports and all their official papers in, and he lost them. They were delayed while they had to go through the whole process again in the American embassy and then through to the Chinese embassy and so on over in Thailand. These things are frustrating experiences, to say the least. Well, when an MK returns, he may be dismayed at the forms, and the Australian MK may be bewildered by the language. Give them time, you say. Not give them guidance. Where do they go for guidance if their parents are in the field? In Australia, do bureaucrats chew you out like they do the ignorant civilian in the host country? These things are sort of nerve-wracking experiences until they have been through several times, and if they can find somebody who's helpful to them, then it's quite reassuring. The eighth point is the question of driving. Perhaps the place where MKs feel most disadvantaged is that every teenager who has left school drives a car back here in Australia, and many of them own a car. In the host country, perhaps, they could not apply for a license until they were 20 years old. Several schools for MKs now have driving instruction where they learn basic driving skills on the campus. They cannot develop road sense because they can't take the car out onto the roads. As a matter of fact, in Taiwan, for instance, all the driving must be done at a driving school or on a campus. You can't take the car out onto the road until after you have the license to drive a car. That has problems. Australian MKs may have learned to drive by US rules, sitting in the left-hand seat. The changes are quickly made back in Australia. If they have driven, say in Taiwan, they have learned to be savage, competitive and discourteous. They can slow the car in the middle of the road and open the door and spit out a mouthful of Beetlejuice. They can jump the lights, ignore double lines, overtake on both sides. But they do learn a kitful of survival skills. A short time in Australia will either change their style or put them in hospital. But supposing the MK has no car, is an ancient 19 years old with parents on the field, have you the grace and adequate insurance cover to teach an MK to drive? Shearing my ewe lamb, you object. I'm not making a formal demand, only planting a thought for the Holy Spirit to work with. It's something which is tremendously important to a teenager, isn't it? And it's something that can be prayed about. The next question is the problem of affluency. Most MKs are not really prepared for the affluence of their home country as compared with the host country. This is not true for all cases in this generation. It produces a sort of ambivalence. On the one hand, wanting to get their hands on all they can grab. On the other, a critical and guilty feeling when they think of the poverty of less privileged people. They see a family of two parents and three young people with five cars. It may seem extravagant till the MK discovers that they go to 5 different places of work and live 5 lives. It takes time for the MK to discover that he or she may be unjust to accuse them of greed. People in the home country have grown into a cultural behavior which is to them so normal and necessary that it may involve no moral decision at all. It's simply a matter of necessity, and that's the way we cope with it. The 10th point, churches. I think we can leave the comments on this to the next lecture. Just one suggestion. Church may not be as helpful to MKs as CYC or a Christian music group or a parachurch fellowship at the start. For a sort of high church Christian brethren, that's a statement made with pain. Bridging cultural gaps is perhaps the MK's first need. If young people feel restless in your church fellowship when they first come back, be patient. Perhaps that's not the best place for them to start their Christian experience back home. We'll explain why more clearly, I hope, in the next lecture. Perhaps the fact that most Australian MKs come from their third culture life in the northern hemisphere to home country life in the southern hemisphere could be turned to advantage. Australia is a good country. Australians are a pretty decent, though queer, mob. Australia has a feel about it that gets you. On the other hand, the gap in time when schools close for a summer vacation in the northern hemisphere and schools start their academic year in the southern hemisphere could be turned into a good orientation course in which eyes can be opened to see a living Australia, the career options can be examined, new friends can be made. Perhaps a few weeks working and earning would teach Australian cultural values. I'm here to give ideas, not to make them workable. That's your privilege. Now, I want to deal with another point. We're trying to pack as much into these 3 lectures as we can possibly manage. If I can just go over that last point again, I'm not here to make anything workable to you, but just to throw ideas to you, asking you to think about these things and to see how they can be adapted, how they can be used, perhaps to stimulate our thinking in helping not only MKs but all the strangers who come into our midst. I want to deal a little now with emotional and psychological problems. This is where I start walking on eggshells. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychological counsellor, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm only a general practitioner who has dabbled a little in the problems of MKs. I don't think I can even spell id correctly every time. One friend from the USA who had taken some courses in psychological counselling once remarked that, taken as a group, missionaries have a rather poor psychological profile. They are aggressive, ambitious, autocratic, stubborn, ridden with guilt feelings over unreached goals and the failures of their strategies. They are poor spiritual achievements and the conflicts of family and work. They have guilt feelings about having so much more than their counterparts in the host country churches. They are workaholics to the point of breakdown and crushed by the weight of unanswered letters. That's about right, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Some of these are strong points carried too far. The question is, would they have made it to the mission field if they were really nice people? Well, that's an area of study others can pursue. If we are to look for the roots of the problems in MKs, do we start with the parents? I would like to say with a great deal of emphasis that problems we are going to discuss are not directly related to faults in the parents, nor can they be traced to a lack of warmth or love in the parent-child relationship, that is, as a rule. Nor are they rooted in theological shortcomings. There is no easy cause and effect relation that I can suggest. We're concerned now about the emotional problems of the children themselves. It is quite normal for MKs to be subject to horrible attacks of homesickness and feelings of isolation and loneliness. For all of us, our mood swings from high to low, from elation to depression. When we are especially happy, we release our feelings with excited speech, laughing, and rapid movements. When we are sad or depressed, we release our feelings with damped down speech, crying, and slowed responses. MKs need never be ashamed of sobbing their hearts out or weeping their eyes out, not even the fellows. This is something which some of them get a little bit anxious about, afraid that maybe somebody would see them, and so they do their crying at night. Sometimes we feel it is wrong to have these emotional reactions and not loyal to our parents. We are ashamed to appear weak, revealing the non-victorious or defeated Christian life. Aren't missionaries supposed to have foreheads of brass, stiff upper lips and hearts of oak? Aren't their children supposed to be reproductions of the same kind? Should MKs tell their parents how they feel? By the time the parents have the MK's letter, they will be over that attack. Then who can they tell? Is there anyone who can understand them as well as another MK? I was interested in one young man whose family are not evangelical in our sense of the word, whose final selection of a college for further studies was influenced by the fact that he would be near some other MKs. MKs of Australia, unite. The mutual support you had in the third culture community is worth the effort of keeping it alive at home. In other words, MKs are often the best counsellors for MKs, because there's someone who can relate to their particular needs and come up with the answers, having been through perhaps the same problems that they had. Writing letters. In these days, many parents on the field urge their MKs to telephone them and reverse the charges. They do that whether you tell them or not. When there is any need for an urgent consultation, I wonder if this is an area of help that can be developed. There are many missionaries now who just simply advise their families, if you're in any trouble, give us a call. It doesn't matter when, just call us and talk to us. And if you have a lot to pour out, all right, we'll see what we can do to cope with it. But at least get it out of your system. Writing letters, even going by email, is a slow way of contact. It may be the only way in some countries, but where it is possible, the telephone is perhaps a very good means of the best means of communication. The only trouble, of course, is the expense of it. But from what we're finding, missionaries are willing to go without a lot of other things, provided that they can solve their children's problems in a short time. The ROC offers to foreign students a free home call for Mother's Day. The Republic of China, in Taiwan, in other words. They offer this to all those who are studying Chinese in the approved schools in Taiwan, a free home call on Mother's Day. Who'd foot the bill in Australia? You, of course. Good idea, wouldn't it?
We could ask Fort Keating. We could ask Fort Keating, maybe.
Yes. Some folk at home try to be friendly and ask questions of the missionary child, but the questions are sometimes so ill-timed that the response may appear to be a rude reply. It is the MK's way of holding back the flood of emotions ready to burst the dam. How should an MK answer the question, "I suppose you miss your parents terribly"? Or, "I suppose you much prefer to live in Australia after life in Whoop Whoop"? How do you answer a question like that? Now, that is for the normal emotional reactions. Depression is a frequent reaction among MKs. Mostly in life, day follows night, spring follows winter. Is that true of Australia in the sense the poets mean? And after a time of depression comes a time of happiness. Sometimes MKs are not able to cope with the change from third culture life to the home country. Interestingly, the fellows do not cope as well as the girls, as a general rule. The fact that an MK is 18 years old may make him an adult in law, but is he an adult in fact? Some people do mature more slowly than others. Age or graduation from high school are measures of length of life and degree of academic achievement, but are they measures of our capability to cope with cultural changes or spiritual changes? It has become a declared policy of many missions that an MK is given one trip back to the field, if possible, within 3 years of leaving high school. It is a good policy, and it does a tremendous amount to solve emotional problems and to remove the fantasies which develop about the mission field, the school, and the home. And it makes it easier for the MK to adapt to the home country. It would be hard to do that for Australian missionaries, and especially for Australian Assembly missionaries. That's a matter of organisation there. But it is a challenge that needs to be faced and worked out, even if it becomes a policy with a small p. Giving by faith needs to be giving by informed faith. Standing on the promises is not meant to be wobbling on the promises of God. There are cases of depression which require the parent to be with the child. This can be in two ways. Either the parent can come back to the child, or the child can go out to the parent. The way I mention here has been restorative for several MKs I know. The MK comes back to the field, perhaps for a few months, perhaps for a whole year. Parent-child relations then are put on a more adult basis. The problem of anorexia nervosa, which has occurred quite frequently among MKs, I don't know how frequently in comparison with other people of other groups. It seems to be a feature of severe depression. It may be an MK's signal for help. It may be a call for attention. It is thought to be a person's response to a distorted self-image that she, notice the gender, is too fat and so she must lose weight. The reasons why she should feel that way are not always clear. I heard the other day about a young fellow who also had this problem, a young lad in the UK, missionary kid, who had anorexia nervosa. It has been found that those who have an underlying religious faith, a meaningful faith in Christ, have a much better chance of a full recovery. It is, of course, a problem that should be handled by Christian psychiatrists if they're available. It is not for the amateur Christian counsellor. If I can give an illustration, one case of anorexia nervosa that we know something about developed in an MK child in the UK. She was quite able to cope with life in a boarding school while her parents were out on the field. Then she went to nursing school and started a course as an enrolled nurse. And it was while she was there that the pressures, the peer pressure, physical tiredness, the non-Christian behaviour of the social set she moved in led to a sort of a psychological breakdown. Her mother returned home and took her out of that situation and spoke with her about a change of career. She had coped reasonably well in a new job when she went down to London, and she worked as a sort of a governess in a home there. The home owners were just frank atheists. They were very intellectual, very, very bright people, and they had loads of money. She was able to cope with their blatant atheism quite easily. And that kind of thing didn't seem to worry her. But then she started in a tertiary school, and while she was there, again, it was the pressures of that particular situation that started off anorexia again. The exogenous factor here, that is the pressures that came from outside, were largely statements that Christians kept making to her, telling her that her parents were neglecting her by them being out on the field while she was needing them at home. Her parents were depriving her of her proper needed care. Her parents did not love her as much as they loved their work. Her parents were misguided as missionaries. And most of this came from Christian people. And that, of course, made a real problem for her. For on the one hand, she could feel supportive of her parents. On the other hand, she was being made to feel that her parents were depriving her. It has taken a long time for her to be able to break these things out into the open and to speak about them. She got over them long before she was willing to talk about them. But now, we praise the Lord, she's out of that trouble altogether. Now, these are things which do happen to missionary children. Psychotic diseases, that is actual mental illness, psychotic diseases occur among missionaries and MKs. There are probably few serious manifestations in the third culture community among the young people, fewer there than at home, because of the supportive mutual care of the MKs for one another. But on their return to the home country, signs of a loner with a bright mind but unable to adjust and unable to finish courses of study should alert people to take care and, if necessary, guide them to get treatment. The pressures of re-entry only reveal what was present in that case. They do not cause the illness. Another problem in the psychological realm, suicide among young people. Suicide among young people has become one of the distressing features of our society. You may be surprised to know that the rate of suicide is higher among Australian young people than in the USA or the UK. It is often the desperate end of severe depression, and sometimes it is acute, suddenly savagely self-destructive. Over a period of about 5 or 6 years, three children, three MKs, who went through the Morrison Academy, suicided.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
Over a period of about 5 or 6 years, three children, three MKs, who went through the Morrison Academy, suicided. And there were a couple of others who attempted suicide, not very convincingly, but for them, I think their attempt was a sort of a call for help. One young fellow threw himself under a train. One girl took a bottle of aspirin and then drove off into the outback of America into the winter there. After 100 aspirin and a long drive, she just then drove as long as she could, and when the car stopped, she just froze to death. Then another young man, in the morning of one day, was speaking to other people, appeared to be quite normal. He had been having a few heart-searching experiences during a special week of meetings in the Christian college that he was attending, and he felt that he wasn't living up to the standards of the Christian life that was required of him. In actual fact, he was a good lad, and he did know the Lord, and he did trust the Lord. That was the morning. He was with friends and seemed perfectly normal. In the afternoon, the friend who he had been with in the morning discovered him in his room. He had taken a knife and just hacked himself to death. Not just one blow, but savagely destroyed himself. Dr. Esther Schubert Chambers, herself an MK, has attempted to research on this problem among MKs. She has not recorded a case of suicide among high school MKs on the field. She attributes this to the very strong support which MKs offer one another in their community interaction, together with a restraint which the high moral standards of mission schools offer. I recall one case of a lad who was in the Chifu school and whose parents actually lived in Chifu, but later sent him to an American school in Korea. He committed suicide there. That was at least 50 years ago. He threw himself under a train. That makes it history, not modern research, I suppose. There is no data to suggest that MKs fare better than their peers after they leave the third culture for their homeland. This is still under investigation. We can't give any sort of scientific figures for this kind of thing. Why does suicide occur? This is usually due to what we would call the endogenous depression factor. That is, things within the child, rising from within the person, rather than exogenous depression due to pressures from outside. It is not, please underline not several times, it is not an indication of the parent's lack of love, or lack of faith, or devotion to Christ. Nor is it necessarily an indication that the young person was not a true Christian. It means that he was sick, but people hadn't realized it. We have friends, godly, loving, devoted to Christ and his work, who have suffered this calamity, but who have turned it to Christ's victory. To close this lecture, I would like to ask you to think over the Lord's story of the lost son and the waiting father. Some have suggested that the Lord put into that story what he knew of the love of God, the mercy of God, the forgiveness of God, the grace of God, and the beauty of God. I don't think we can spoil it by asking these questions. First, was the attitude and behavior of the father psychologically and spiritually sound before the younger son left home? Was it psychologically and spiritually sound while he was away? Was it right the way he treated him on his return? Second question, who dug the generation gaps? The father, the younger son, or the older brother? The third point, does the inactivity of the father show a lack of concern for his lost son? Should he have gone looking for him? Should he have sent the older brother to look for his brother? Did the younger son deserve the father's reconciling treatment as a social right? The fifth point, should the elder brother have shown more social responsibility on his own initiative? Did the father, by not mentioning this to the older brother, put out the welcome mat for him too? And the sixth point, was the father soft? Did he show favoritism or inequality in treatment of his two sons? The older brother would be his younger brother's prosecutor, given the chance. The younger brother was his own judge. The father did not utter a judgmental verdict. He spoke of the lostness, the deadness of his son. Thoughts, not forensic, but matters of relationship and the condition of life that resulted from a broken relationship. Was the father right? Could we do better? Now, out of what we have said, are there questions that you'd like to ask?
I think there is a problem when parents and children, particularly children who've been away in boarding school from age 5 up to when they're 14, when they come home, it's difficult for the parents and children to have a right family relationship. I think while they're in school, they treat the parents as people who look after them during holidays. And when they come home, the child has been making his own bed, making his own decisions for the last 8 or 9 years. And when he comes home and someone starts to suggest that he does things in a different way, it does cause problems because the child's been making up his own mind for quite a while. And I think there is a real difficulty in, again, integrating children and parents back into a family relationship. And this causes a lot of, stress in the mind of the children. The fact that they're no longer independent. They now have someone who says they love them who keeps telling them what to do. And I think probably we could throw that one around a little bit too.
I think that's true to experience, all right. I've heard other people mention this problem, that that their relationships with their children, the children could come to the point where they felt that home was just simply the holiday home. And when people come back, sometimes they have to start a completely new way of life. when they return as a family to the home country. Yes.
I think along with that, Mum hasn't had to do the washing and ironing and scrubbing the floors, and Dad hasn't had to mow the lawn and wash the car, and the children haven't had to help with the gardening and all those things. And I think that can be a problem, coming to term with helping with a lot more work in the house.
We found as parents that the going to the children's home and staying there was best if it was as close as possible to the home. But then we also felt that it was also better if the boarding home was a little bit more regimented than the home, because then they liked coming back home.
The British schools, I think, do better with that than the American schools do in regimenting the situation. The American schools try to make it home away from home and succeed quite well too.
Take it a step further and say that a young couple possibly contemplating a family, or a young couple with a young family, should they seriously contemplate doing the Lord's work in the mission field?
Well,
somebody wrote an article on that, advocating that missionaries should not have children or should restrict them to two. But do we, in some ways in our Christian society, put too much emphasis on children and families? Is there a place for non-families in the mission field?
Just to counteract that, I think children are probably the greatest asset a missionary can have, particularly in an Asian environment where family is such a high influence in the society. Sue, for instance, when she was going to take the 800 mile train journey to school with the children, could travel alone with a child without any fear, because she had a child in the village. The children actually built the relationship between us and the villagers. If we didn't have the children, it would have been difficult for us to approach some of the villagers, but when the children played together and they were great friends together, it was very easy for the parents to get together and forge a friendship. And I think without children it would have been much more difficult. They learnt the language quicker than we did, and they could tell us what people were talking about.
That's true.
Yes. Might I add Africa to the list too? That the childless family in Africa is an anachronism and should not exist. But that where there are children, they do open up the way. Our friend here has put an emphasis that was in the mission field when I went out there, which is a few years ago, 40-odd. But that we have been very glad to see that the family has been going out to more mission fields than it used to go, and that there has been this change produced in the mission fields. And I think it's an essential thing that the missionary be as normal as possible, including his family, when he goes to another field for testimony.
Yes. Some years ago, a young couple went out to the China field, and they spoke to Mr. W.E. Vine. His writings are always rather severe, aren't they? And so on. But he had a great understanding of people. this young couple said to him, "We're getting married and we're going out to the China field. We're getting married, but we, in order that we can do the work properly, we don't propose to have children." And his rejoinder was, "What on earth are you getting married for?" The missionary has to be able to demonstrate a normal life on the mission field, because that's very, very much a part of his active witness. It's not just that he's throwing the Bible at their heads, but he's also trying to demonstrate, illustrate to them the way of life. And so I think that it's unfortunate that the people form judgments which are not given to us in the Bible. And where there are no restrictions placed in the Word of God, we should be extremely careful not to add them in our thinking.
Children have many advantages in being brought up in the mission field, and the advantages far outweigh the liabilities.
Yes, that's true too.
I'm an expatriate kid from Rabaul, PNG. Lived there for 11 years. Business ties with my parents brought us there. I'm married to a missionary kid. I feel that certainly there are things that greatly advantage a missionary kid in that it gives them a greater cultural outlook to different cultures in the world. But certainly we are here today because there's a great problem with kids, missionary kids, coming back to their homeland. And I think that there is that problem there, and so therefore isn't possibly prevention better than a cure? Do you see what I mean, or
okay.
Not quite?
We have to fill the whole Australian culture, though, to prevent it. I'm assuming the fault is in the Australian culture.
I think our brother was suggesting if you don't have the missionaries, don't have kids, there would be prevention.
I suggest that it leads to an unnatural family, whereby in New Guinea, I always had mum and dad to run home to if I had a problem. They were right there. I didn't go to boarding school. Whereas if a child is hundreds of miles away and the telephone is the only source of communication between the two, I think that can lead to great problems. And therefore, possibly, not a normal, maybe an unnatural family atmosphere.
I'm not sure how you can define so clearly a normal or natural family. Taking our family as an example, it's abnormal. But each out of five children, each one has reacted differently to coming back to Australia, and they're still reacting differently. And I think the idea of having a telephone link with mom and dad is not so much the expense side of it, but knowing that they are there if no one else is available. And that's looking at major life questions like employment. What do you think of this type of job that I'd like to go into? And please say it in 3 minutes or less, otherwise I'll put this call on your bill. They try and be noble to start off with, but it never occurred to me to ask my parents to come home with me. I can remember saying, "Why can't I go to the States?" And they were saying, "But you're Australian." And I was thinking, oh, well, I didn't feel it. I mean, to me, being one and feeling one were two different things. And yet my younger sister said she had no problems coming back. She came back when she was in the ninth grade. I came back after I finished high school. The difference is I finished high school a lot easier than she did. So that you're talking about disadvantages and advantages. I think they're different for each child. So we can't really come up with a right or wrong way of doing things. Rather, to look at all the issues. Maybe all the MKs should get together and see how many different ways of returning there is. There are. And how much we can torture them.
Whilst we're on the subject of boarding schools, and I'll change the subject a little bit because my three children went to Clarence High School, Bangalore, where their father was principal. That has its problems too. Not for number one and number three, but for number two, who rebelled and said he wasn't going to do the right thing, even though Dad was principal. On the matter of returning to Australia, my husband had the Black Friars correspondence courses going as well to try and bridge a gap between the senior Cambridge system and the Australian education system. The result was that I've got one child in rooms in full-time Christian work. David's just on the Lord's wait list for whatever. But I have another son who's away from the Lord. So, as you say, it affects each one differently. And with no boarding school, that's the situation with our three.
Pursue a little bit the thought that our brother Mitchell brought forward. We haven't yet been made aware, I think, of any real problems up to about age 11 or something like that. Am I right?
Yes,
yes.
That's right.
The it seems to be the consensus of people who have studied this that if a child returns to the home country before or at the ninth year level, they have a lot less trouble in adapting. It's after that time, I think, that their cultural roots are more strongly formed within the third culture. Before that time, it's a bit straggly compared with later on. But those last 3 years of high school are especially formative in any child's life. And the things which they learn at that particular time are tremendously important to them in their immediate future. I think children up to about the ninth year of schooling usually handle returns better, and then it just becomes an ordinary home problem.
Things like the suicide and anorexia nervosa, are these things more prevalent amongst MKs than under the normal children in Australia, and also amongst say preacher's kids or people from outback coming to towns more so than MKs, or the figures somewhat the same?
There is no definite study on that yet. No established results of study on that yet. It seems that missionary kids don't have a better record than the ordinary young person. The trouble is that, from one point of view, missionary kids are a fairly high profile because of their parents, aren't they? And therefore, if a child of missionary parents develops anorexia, or if the child suicides, then the message goes very widely. It's more noticed. But so far as they can tell, these things are more protected on the mission field and less likely to occur because the peer group is much more supportive there. See, once a child comes back here, young people, as a rule, they go to one school. Their church friends are not their school friends. Their church friends, their school friends, and their their sports friends, maybe three different groups. But out there, they're all the same group. And so everybody lives much more closely together and helps much more closely. Life is so much bound up together that one supports another, and if a person seems a little bit, you know, doing something a little bit odd or so on, others will come on them right away and pull them back the line again. Here, well, if a kid doesn't want to play a sport, nobody cares. That's his option. He needn't. If he doesn't want to join the music group, nobody minds. If he misses out on church, well, that doesn't matter. He may be there next week, but we'll wait till next week to see. But out on the mission field, if you don't go in the morning, somebody's on your back by the afternoon to see why it was you weren't there, what happened, not feeling well, had you something to do, and so on. And so in that way, the support of the peer group is very, very much stronger, so that these things don't manifest. But so far as we know, there's no difference in incidence.
Should that mean for the whole work of the church here, we are falling down in support and peer group support and every other way in supporting a Christian community and the family life in the church? Is it a lack we have here that are able to do it on the mission field? Is there some way we can raise that amongst churches and Christians here?
Well, you're pointing your question to me, but I'm not competent to answer.
I wasn't directing you here.
No, this direction.
Yes.
I could answer that to a certain degree. We came home with three children who were teenagers at that time, and they came here to Eastwood Assembly, and they found it very, very supportive, and I think a good base of their present Christian life developed here in the Assembly of Eastwood. So it wasn't that they were neglected when they came home. And I think it depends on the position, the Assembly and things like that. But I can only say I've got the highest regard for what was done by the Christians here when our children came.
That's good.
I'd like to raise one thing that I've been thinking of since this the end of your talk, and that is the effect of materialism on children coming from a country where virtually materialism just doesn't exist. They come back and understand the horror of materialism, and they might even perceive it and comment very, very perceptibly about it, but before very long, materialism begins to affect them and they become guilty about their inner quiet submission to materialism, and that is a real conflict in their lives. I believe that has a real part to play in causing problems among kids. Now, to add to that then, I think that we're all learning together, and therefore we should all be doing our best to teach and include in our Bible teaching and in the fellowship of the church some teaching and comment and observation on this matter. And being aware of it, then do something to try and improve the situation for returning families.
Just to add to that comment, one thing that impressed me on my trip to furlough, I think the best thing about coming back on furlough is that people had colour TV. And we weren't allowed to have a TV. And we used to encourage Mum and Dad to go out as much as they could so we could watch other people's TV. But I think in our own very little, young, immature and very judgmental minds, we couldn't understand why home Christians had TVs but they couldn't send out money to help where we saw a need. And that's not a criticism of people here. I've been back long enough and I have a colour TV and a black and white TV. I take it both. We don't have a video though. But the point I'm talking about is that what's acceptable here is very hard for a young child, and at the age of 18, you are a young child, to to handle all the conflict. I mean, which is right? What your parents had, and you were comfortable, you didn't know any different. Well, you didn't really know anything differently. Or the people here who are just as good a Christian as your parents.
That's got a cultural answer. Now, we have grandchildren in the mission field. When they were home in Australia, they were virtually TV addicts. Now they're in Nepal, they haven't got TV, it doesn't seem to bother them at all. They just adapt to that new situation. This is getting on quite a while. So I think it's just a cultural thing. I don't think you can...
Well, used to make us amused was that Taiwan had colour TV before Australia did. It's just that we weren't allowed to watch it. We were told to read good books.
Chickens take a long time to come home and roost.
You can see her later.
Yes.
You mentioned, Dr. Nichols, the point of the MK returning need to talk about his experiences and be heard encouragingly. What our three older children found was that in the context of uni and school among their peers, that it started to become a dividing thing, and you know, as if they were showing off. And what they learned and told us was they needed to talk about their experiences but not locate them, not even tell them that they were experiences overseas, but they needed to share with their peers that, but the fact of locating it sort of made them different.
That's a very common complaint, a very common observation of MKs. I suppose the people that are best able to hear them are other MKs. It may be one of the problems that we have altogether, not just among missionary children, but at their parents' level also, that often as we visit people, they talk to us about themselves and their interests, and very seldom ask questions about what we're doing. And what is the way you respond to that? Cut them off and break in, or just let them go? Is this the problem of being able to share with other people a deep interest? If people won't listen, very often it's because they can't hear. They haven't read or been particularly interested in other parts of the world. It's not meaningful to them, and therefore it's really not a conversation piece. But being a good listener is probably one of the most important parts of communication, not being a good talker. Is that right, sir?
Missionaries
are good talkers, aren't they? Yes. I've been sitting in a divided state inside me ever since you put that attitudes activities thing up on the overhead, because if we were going to respond to all the specific problems of MKs, we'd have to have about 20 degrees to be able to even understand the issues involved, and most of us don't have any of those qualifications. The real question comes down to whether we're going to have a commitment towards them. Even in our lack of skill, if we're confronted with a missionary family either going out or coming back, will we have any commitment towards them? And the concern I have about that is, it comes from 1 John where it says, you know, if I can't love the bloke next to me, how can I love God? And if we say, yeah, I can manage to do this for someone far away in another country, is it real if I'm not doing it for the person who's in my own fellowship right beside me now? So what it really comes down to is will we have that sort of commitment that you're talking about for MKs to everyone? Because we can't, if we only reserve it for MKs, it's not real at all. And it comes down to a real personal issue of will you have that sort of level of commitment to other Christians, regardless of what circumstance they're in, and be prepared to help them in whatever limited skills you've got. And I find that, like the story that the Lord told, where the father came up and said to one son, will you go and do this for me in the field? And he said, no. And went and did it. Ellerberg said, yes, and didn't. We all have this instantaneous response when we hear you or talk and read your notes, oh yes, we ought to do more. What I'm concerned about is that next week I won't have done anything more, and 3 months ahead I won't have done anything, and in 10 years' time nothing will have happened, because we've given mental assent with our root. But the reality is that we don't actually do anything, because we're not doing that sort of thing that you're asking for us to do to the MK. We're not doing that in our own fellowships to one another.
I wonder if I could just make a comment about the questions that were raised with regard to the parable of the prodigal. I think it's a mistake to take the parable of the prodigal in isolation, because it's only one parable in three in Luke chapter 15, or if you like it, it's one third of a parable. Now, why didn't the father go into the far country? Well, the father represents God in heaven. He couldn't possibly go into the far country. But the first parable, or the first part of the parable, is about the shepherd going. And that's the Lord himself. And then the second one is about the woman there lighting the lamp, the work of the Holy Spirit in the far country. And so you have to take the three of them together and remember that they're pictures of the scribes and the Pharisees on the one hand, that was the elder brother, and the sinners on the other hand, that are mentioned in verse 2.
Thank you. Now, our time is up here. I would just like to make one observation with regard to the matter of materialism. I think, again, this is a matter of attitudes rather than direct sort of confronting kind of teaching. I think it was Campbell Morgan who makes the point that in his parables the Lord speaks of money and wealth more than on any other subject, if you go through his parables, and that's a very interesting point. If you study them up, it sort of hones our thinking with regard to things. Missionary children have a problem here because they move from one set of circumstances to another set. They form judgments which often later on they'll reverse, and it isn't a case of reneging on earlier standards. It's a matter of getting new insights. I think that probably the matter of materialism is a question not of having or not having, but a matter of stewardship of what we have, and that probably is the key thought. The stewardship of what God has given us. And I think where as Christians we learn that, then having is not important, not having is not important, but using what we have for God is the thing that really counts. Right. Alan, would you close in prayer, please?
The following comments are the remainder of those from the first session that would not fit on the tape.
It's very easy for the children to feel that the home church is the home church of the parents, and it's not their home church. I think we all feel that there is much that the home church or assembly can do to support a missionary family going on, and I agree that there needs to be that involvement right across the whole level of the home church, and an ongoing one. If your children have got that sense of belonging, then it's much easier when they come back.
Secondary problem than that. We went to India from Newcastle, and when we came home, we settled in Sydney. So, what was our home church originally? Didn't work really the same home church we came back to.
It's all this problem with these roots, isn't it? We change and put down new roots. And the church that we left has changed while we were away, and the soil has changed.
With the, you know, other home churches, one thing that we had mentioned to us coming back by people, even within Australia, changing cities, changing places, the children need to go to a youth group. They need a church where there is a number of young people so they can fit in, and even more so for MKs coming home. It's very difficult for the children coming to a church where it's really all old people, which may be some of the assemblies. If the young people's group is very small, it's very hard for them to fit in as strangers to the culture, strangers to everything. And they're sort of right out there all by themselves, no one much around. They need very much peer group pressure. And people have even said that you really need to go to where your children are going to be at home at church, not where you are.
Our children went to a union church in India, and when they came home and went to the meeting here, our younger daughter said in the Bible class, "I don't like this kind of church. We ought to have a minister." And she said, "Everybody's mouths open." So she wondered what she said wrong.
One other point that I think too, very often missionaries, people seem to be reluctant to put in their letters what's happening with their children, and often Christians aren't really informed about the children. The letters that we read will say so much about the work that they're doing and the ministry they're involved in, but very often doesn't list their children and what they're doing so that people can be informed about them. I think sometimes we have to get over our own reluctance to talk about our children.
I think it's probably time we close this session. I take it there have been several ripples that have started, and that's good. In the two sessions to follow, I hope we'll make more. And I think if we can just make one suggestion at this point. Probably we need to think more in terms of attitudes than in actual activities if we're going to be able to handle this, because we can create situations or we can do things which might be still unsuitable. The thing needs to go deeper than that to attitudes, so that this, I think, fairly well sums up what we have been dealing with in the discussions this morning. The situation or the development of a child is a fairly complex thing, and it's very difficult for us to plan, to legislate, to direct in particulars. But even in generalizations, sometimes there can be misunderstandings, but the fundamental problem is one of our own attitudes, which then are born in our own spiritual life. Well, I think we should close the session.
It's best, I think, that we give thanks for the food while we're all together. What time should we resume?